episode of Word for Word may contain language or themes that are not suitable for all listeners. If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1-800-184-527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. Today's guest is a renowned Melbourne artist who's worked in a variety of formats ranging from printmaking, fashion, painting and performance, and interior design. His work can be found in places such as the National Gallery of Victoria, Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, and the Albert Museum in London. He's also left his distinct imprint on Melbourne's queer scene and has on occasion been described as one of Melbourne's best dressed men. Welcome to Word for Word, Gavin Brown.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It's an honour and a privilege to be here.
Thank you. It's good to have you here. Now, I was just saying before we started off here that I'm a bit of an art philistine, but your work is very recognisable to me. It is a particular style, and when I see it either in a gallery or at someone's house, which I'm privileged to see, I know it's yours straight away, even without looking at the signature. Tell me about your particular style.
I think that comes with time. And I think it's a distinct advantage to have a style. I didn't go out of my way to create a style. Style is just something that's inherent in, with you. And I think it starts from very early days. I recently, on my Instagram, I went home to my folks and found a painting that I'd done at my college days, and it was 83. And I'm looking at work now, and I could still see the same strokes and the same energy and the sort of direction that I'd done a full loop and going back, and I could see the essence of where I am now with that work, which I did, you know, well over 30 years ago.
When you talk about, when you use the word energy in an art form on a canvas, what do you mean?
Have something coming from the canvas or a piece of work that the intent to have the energy. I think when a viewer looks at something, what they're getting from it, and my intent is to have a connection with the viewer. And I think with the mark making and stroke, the passion that I put into each line or gesture I make, it resonates a sort of energy, and I like to feel that the viewer can get some of that back by viewing the work and seeing that the mark making resonates with them.
Because when I've looked at your work more than once, I always see something new in there, or I just see more detail than I saw the first time.
There are hidden things in my work. I do that subconsciously and consciously. I'm definitely a maximus.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, you know, some people are minimalists and they have very quiet worlds and quiet, you know, I'm the opposite. I like to fill up my life and fill up my home, fill up my what I wear, fill up my art.
Well, I've never seen you in a pair of jeans and a beige shirt or anything. You always look amazing, even when you're sort of casually dressed.
I've always been interested in creating an image. I think as a child, I lived in a fantasy world. Nothing was going to happen unless I made it happen as I got older. And I think that dressing up or, you know, putting more effort into what you're doing, I just call it, people go, oh, you look good, don't I? Go, yeah, I made an effort. And it's part of, like, who I am. I feel naked if I'm not sort of expressing myself. But, I mean, I do it for me. You know.
Can we talk about your family? Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have parents? A sister. She's a lawyer for legal aid.
Is she older or younger?
She's 3 years older. Mm-hmm. And my parents are still both alive.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up on the Mornington Peninsula in sort of South Frankston, and I went to school in Baxter and that whole area. So, yeah.
And how did you come into art?
Well, My mother was an art teacher. She actually volunteers at the Positive Living Centre, teaching a lot of great students and there still to this day. She was always an art teacher, and my father was a painter. He should have been a painter, but he went off and pursued trying to make a living to support a family. And I was surrounded by art books and encouraged. There was gallery visits, and, you know, that world was open to me. My sister has no interest in that. She is into sports, so go figure. So,
does she have an interest in your work? Does she come to your exhibition?
Yeah, she goes to my...
Your parents?
Yes. They're big supporters and always have been. You know, it's a two-way sword. It's, you know, you feel that you've never succeed enough, and at the same time, you know, it's great. I always knew I was going to be a painter, even, you know, when I was in primary school and people say, what are you going to be? I said, well, I'm going to be an artist.
And what did they think of that?
I think people thought I was going to go to the National Gallery and restore paintings. That's what they always said, oh, that's what artists do. And I go, no, I'm going to make paintings. The journey was to become, and the journey is to become an artist, and that's what I have achieved and trying to continue to pursue is this life as authentically as I possibly can.
So when you're a teenager and you're sort of heading towards the end of school and thinking about, you know, what you're going to do next, it was your aim to be a full-time artist?
Well, I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I knew it was going to happen. So because academically I was, I had no interest. And I think people thought, well, he's got to have to do something. So I think he's pretty good at this. And I was, you know, so I was sort of pushed to that direction as well, which is sort of, I hope it's working for me.
It's panned out. Have you ever had a conventional job?
I worked at the Black Cat once.
Did you? Once?
I bent my hand on the coffee machine and I said, God is my witness, I'll never work another day in my life again. that was a long time ago. So
it's pretty amazing to have, you know, as a very young child, maybe primary school, have said, I want to be an artist, I want to live as an artist, I want to earn my money that way, and to actually have fulfilled that dream. It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, I'm a man of my time, but I've always had this romantic vision of, this is what, you know, you can do it. And, you know, it just hasn't been smooth sailing. I mean, I think I've learned to create opportunities for myself being an artist. That's when we probably get into it more about doing other things to create an income. But to always have, if you do what you're good at and you can sort of succeed a bit better, I think that your strengths will come to the forefront.
But I guess, you know, creating art and being an artist and coming up with amazing ideas and putting them onto canvas or whatever medium, that's very different from the industry of art. And I'm wanting your thoughts on the difference between, you know, that sort of marketing side or, you know, organising exhibitions, and actually it's a very different skill.
Yeah, I haven't been that successful in the mainstream art world. I sort of go beat to my own drum, and I've probably my downfall is not playing the game correctly, which it is like any industry that people, it's a networking thing, and if you're prepared to network, you can probably pursue but want to be authentic and a one-off and an original. And I look at the art world sometimes and go, it's the same thing, you know, what's in, who's in, what's it, you know, and it's like, I even put on my own shows, you know, I rent places because dealers do my head in, but, you know, I mean, there are good dealers there, of course, but...
Is there interest from dealers?
Yeah, I mean, if I was in another state, if I'm showing in another state or that's crucial, but in this state, you know, people know who I am, and I feel like I do the same amount of work if I put on a show myself or get someone to take half of what I've earned in this state.
And does that also mean if you're organising your own shows and curating all that stuff, does that mean that you don't feel that you have to produce for anyone but yourself?
If I try and find the market or try and second guess myself, it's confusing. And you get lost. And, you know, sometimes you go down a road, like I'll start painting a direction And I'm going, okay, that's done now. And I was trying to put a work in for the Sulman Prize, which is part of the Archibald. And I was trying to go, right, what do they want to see? And, you know, it was the worst thing, you know. And I knew, I ticked that box and I'll play, you know, I'll give them this and it's for Sydney and they want that, you know. And, of course, I just went, I can't do this. And then I went, you just stop, paint what you want, and if they don't hang it, fine. It's going to be good. If you try and, you know, second guess what people want, you confuse yourself. So if I'm hung or not, there's a painting I really like at the end of the day. So, yeah.
How often do you get through part of the process and then think, I actually don't like this, the way you're just referring to now?
You know, not every painting you paint is going to be successful, but it's a stepping stone to the next work. So your confidence and your self-assurance sort of comes because you've got so much work behind you, and I am prolific. I produce so much work. That body of work informs the next step of work. So you trust yourself and your judgment more and more what this work, well, should look like or will become, or, you know, I mean, it's great working because you come across and grow with it. I see a lot of artists that I know sort of get stuck with one thing that they do and they're known for it, and then they get pigeonholed and they're almost like, but that's what you do. I like to just keep pushing my boundaries, and each show looks, even though it has my own distinctive handwriting, it has a different theme or it's moved on from the last show.
A lot of your stuff strikes me as having, you know, animals in it, birds, sort of nature references, not all of it, but a lot of the material I've seen. Being an urban dweller, what's your relationship with the natural world?
No, would have called myself a figurative painter. And there's sort of certain words in art which sort of, you know, taboo words, you know, decorative or, you know, design, and those words are just no go. And I sort of have had a history of doing textile design, and that I was doing quite a lot of figurative work, and I just wasn't using reference points, photos, drawings, and quite tight. And I, 5 years ago, I decided to just go into my subconsciousness and start painting just out of my head and not use any reference points. And I went all the way back to the school I grew up, went to a very environmental friendly school called Woodley, and they grew native flowers and they used to harvest them. And that's what came out, and I didn't fight it, and that's why it looked like work that I did a long time ago, and that's the work that I had been doing. So I go back to that work, but then I have another whole lot of sides of my work.
Because a lot of it is very colourful. You know, it's very heavy on colour, very vibrant. It leaps off the canvas.
Yeah, I am a colourist, yeah. I'm not scared of colour at all. It's just controlling it and using it, and it's joyous. And I like putting things that shouldn't work together and make them work together.
Did you go to art school?
I did, yeah. I went to RMIT just up the road from here.
Was that more technique for you, or is that where you honed your style, do you think?
Definitely technique. The great thing about going there was still at that day, they did more of a formal training. So technique and all that side of the art practice I learned. So I think it's, and then from there you can always, you know, figure drawing, or you can go from there. You need the grounding and the basis. And I look at sometimes at people going straight there and go, yeah, but you've got to know how to draw the figure, or you've got to know how to, and then you can deconstruct it. So I'm a firm believer in knowing your craft and your skill and your and then you refine it for the rest of your life.
Once you've started a piece, generally how long does it take until you're happy with it?
I always say a piece of string. Yeah. How long's a piece of string? Because it's, you know, I mean, once I would work, I'd have one canvas and I'd finish it. Now, with the work that I do, I might have four going at the same time and then going back so I can build up layers and let work dry and give it some time to breathe, and because I'm working in a different way from where I would have a figure and I'm painting the hand today, I'm painting the face today. I actually have to get myself into a zone. I know it sounds a bit silly, you know, if you don't understand. You just can't go through the motions.
So you're pretty disciplined with your art too. You pretty much go into your studio at 9 in the morning and...
Earlier some days, yeah.
And finish at 5, like a proper job.
It's a proper job, yeah.
Do you ever have days where you just, it's just nothing's happening for you?
I do call them background days.
Your background?
Yeah, so I'll paint the background.
Is that easier?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, not the main, like that hand that you've got to get right or something. Yeah. I've learned to be disciplined. I wasn't always disciplined. I mean, when you're younger, there's a lot of distractions. And as you're older, I'm not going anywhere, but you do feel like you're running out of time. I need to concentrate and I need to go, I'm inspired. And I would paint some beautiful work and I could see the energy. And now I've sort of created a time to try and reproduce that energy. And it is by discipline. I always say it's like a gymnast and they go and do that somersault every day. And they just do it and they know how to do it, but they do it and do it and do it and do it and do it. And then they get it perfect at it. Making that gestural stroke is that somersault for me. You know, you do it and do it and do it, and sometimes you get it right, you know.
So how much of the idea of the end of it do you have at the start?
It depends what work I'm doing. If I'm working from a drawing or I have work from collages that I constructed, I sort of know what it's going to look like or I'm in trouble because that's what I'm trying to do. With the newer work, I'm just don't know and I'm falling into the abyss and I'm quite enjoying it.
Why the change in technique, do you think?
To keep myself amused, to keep myself alive and act, and to keep myself growing. As I said before, you know, I see some artists and they're stuck and they keep doing it. I just want to keep pushing and, you know, some things are more successful than others and that's fine.
Does your mother have any role in your art? Does she come along and have a look at what you're working at?
She does, very much so. And though we like, you know, mother and son, and I'm like, oh, she's coming today. I've got, you know, what have you done? Have you done enough? But also she's right. Now, sometimes I don't want to, yeah, well, that hand is a bit, that shoulder's a bit. And you just go, oh, why don't you? And then you go, yep, she's right. Yeah. So it is clear eye. And someone's going to tell you. Truthfully, like, you know, when you're out in the public, no one cares. Like, it is wrong and it's going to be wrong forever. So fix it.
Thanks, Mum.
Yeah, thanks, Mum. And she's right. So,
How often does she come to visit?
Once a fortnight. Right. You know, I've got my work ready. I'm waiting. I've done all this new work and I'll wait for her to see this new work and see her reaction. And I can tell, yeah, she doesn't. And then, you know, I can see if I'm in the right direction. And, yeah. Today, I think you do always try and seek your parents' approval for the rest of your life. I mean, it's just something you do.
Is the aim of each of your pieces to be on a wall?
There's a wall for each painting. And I find that sometimes when I have a show, and it doesn't, like, walk off the wall. Because I've changed my style or I've changed the subject matter, and people go, oh, I actually liked his last show. He's doing something different. And then someone might come to the studio and then I go, oh, that show I had in 2008, which I didn't think was, you know, didn't sell, you know, or I just realised I've sold everything. So it eventually finds a home.
What's the hardest thing to paint? And I'm asking this with something in mind because an artist once told me that pug dogs, of which I have three, are very, very hard to paint because they have flat faces.
Actually, what I find is women with makeup on because there's a mask and I watch a lot of portrait painters. I find that, hard because you're trying to find the soul and you're trying to find the lines and the wrinkles, but
the expressions?
Yeah. And sometimes, I find that a little bit to get into their soul. Yeah, portraits are sort of something that I do, but I'm getting away from because I find that people, you know, they're just never happy unless you lie.
So you have to make them
younger. And then everyone else goes, isn't that one? Who is it? Yeah,
so, it's funny how we see each other.
Yeah.
We see ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I haven't been to your place, your house, your flat, but it's quite renowned. It's been in a lot of magazines. I've seen it. I was doing a lot of research on you, stalking you on the internet. It's been in Vogue and all sorts of there's some amazing photos of it. It's actually got a nickname, Knickknack Castle.
Yeah. My friend Chris Orr named it that.
Oh, was it Chris?
Yeah, it was Chris Orr. He's always one for a great a wordsmith, that man.
That, from what I've seen of the photos, it looks like an extension of your art.
Yeah, it looks like a painting.
It's like an expression of you, isn't it?
It's a big still life. Yeah.
How long have you been there?
Far too long. I've been there, well, nearly half my life now. Since 93. 92, I bought the place, yeah. So,
do you want to describe it?
Cabinet of curiosities. It is overwhelming. I am a collector of the decorative and antiques, and I like living with older things, and it's probably not the most comfortable flat, but it is one of the most fascinating flats and environments. I mean, it has been documented around. Like, I look online sometimes, oh, that's over, that house is, you know, on someone's, you know, on a Russian website or something. So it's just in a book called Bohemian Living. Yeah, it's just me following what I am an effete. The aesthetic is important to me. If there's two ways to walk home and one's longer but it's pretty, if there's something interesting, I'll go the long way, because there's so much ugliness in this world. I always say your house is only as good as the ugliest thing in there. And so it's me creating a fantasy again. And why can't it be like that? You know, why can't I create this environment and a capsule? You know, the world is pretty grim sometimes, and sometimes you just want to be in your own cave. And, you know, okay, it's a bubble, but it's my bubble, and it's an, you know, it's an expression of who I am, and I don't care what other people think. It's for me, and I sit there and move things around. It's like a big still life that I play with and I adjust. And yeah, I love to. I always dream of like this big white cavern room. I went to Japan and stayed in an Airbnb and with a friend, and we were with my partner, and I said, oh, we'll stay in this white box. You sure? I go, yeah, this is going to be great, the white box. So I get into this white box and like that. And that day I went to a market, antique, like a fair market in Japan, Tokyo. And by the end of it, the day, I had a shrine there. I had like a, you know, there's an altar and there's something hanging over there. And it just, you know, if I went camping, by the end of the day, there'd be, you know, shells and feathers hanging off the tent. You know, that's just who I am.
So if you go and stay in a motel somewhere, or, I don't know, you know, someone's house for a weekend, do you find it stifling if it's not terribly interesting?
I'm really full of that. I don't want to be an ungrateful guest. There's always something to look at. There's always something to find.
I picked out a couple of quotes that I found when I was stalking you. Out with the old and in with the older.
Yes.
I love that one. And also that you described your home as, it's my stage, my jewel box, my haven and my cabinet of curiosities. I get to edit my personal drama there.
Yep.
That sums up your
home. Yeah, yeah. I probably don't have enough people in there, but probably should have lived 200 years ago in Europe somewhere. And I sort of went to I did go to a place in Venice. It was a fabric mill. I walked into this room and I went, oh, God, I love this. And it was just at their shop front. Like, oh, you should have a look at this room. And we walked in and I went, I'm going to create that. And so, yeah, I really like small museum galleries as well. Beautiful objects. And I did, back years ago, have some friends who were major collectors as well, which influenced me. So, and I take that out on that energy is out on the street, and what I wear, and curate myself, and curate my house, and curate my art. And it comes naturally. It sounds like it's all like, oh my God, that's a lot of work. It's not. It's
just who you are.
It's just who I am. Yeah.
Now you travel quite extensively. Do you seek out places to pick up things for your collection?
I'm pretty good at like working out how to get that into my suitcase. I don't. It's like I don't go to a place to be inspired either. It just happens, and sometimes it happens back in the studio. I did go to Cambodia a couple of years ago, and I'm not going to go to a third world country and go, oh, there's a show. Or there, you know, but it just happens organically. And yeah, I went to India late last year, and I'd, you know, everyone thought I'd been there so many times. I had never been there. I'm pretty good at going down that little road and finding that thing that's got my name. They find me. So, yeah, I am like, I don't need any of this, but, you know, it's fun, you know, the hunt.
Do you have
fun.
A one thing in, one thing out policy? Like, where do you put all this?
Oh, it's just sort of, you just move, you know, and just to be a couple of feet, now it's a couple of, couple of centimetres, you just move something across and then it fits in.
Because you had a unique living situation with your ex-partner, who sadly you've no longer seeing.
Yep.
And you live next door to each other.
Yep.
And
we still do.
You still
yep.
do.
Yep.
And you had a working relationship.
Yep.
Did you used to buy things for each other's places?
No, he just would get home at night and laugh and go, oh, and he'd see something in his house and go, well, he knew that I'd bought something and something would go to the other wing, I'd call it. Oh, well, it's going at you. And then I started buying, yeah, I needed that. And I just didn't have room for it. So it would go into his and, yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, he loved that side too. I mean, he loves, you know, thing. He does interior design and work there. So it wasn't just, I'm not practical, you know. My house might be cold in winter, you know, But I bought this beautiful chair. And they'll be, yeah, that's your heating. And I'm going, yeah, but I'd rather have the chair. So, yeah. So.
Now, you've sadly broken up. Has the past 12 months, is it imposing itself on your art?
It's made me throw myself into my art. What do we say, a negative into a positive? And maybe when I look back in years to come, I can see it clearly, but I certainly can't see it at the moment. But I certainly have thrown myself into my work. I think it's a great positive anyway out of a negative. In the long run, it's, you know, maybe it's not a negative, but when you're in the middle of it all, you feel that, oh God, you just got everything sorted out, and then you're starting again, aren't you? And but that's life, isn't it? I mean, there's no there's no rules, or there's no one path, and it's just going to be like, oh, that's it, and you know, I've got it all sorted, because I don't think any of us have got it sorted. No one knows what's around the corner, so throwing myself into the work is a great thing, and I'm even more prolific now. So every time I feel that I need to working is also a bit about mental health, where I have that outlet and I can channel, yeah, well, I suppose what you were saying is it affected, well, maybe not so much in the subject matter, maybe more in the work, in the go and work. You know, like when people say, oh, you feel this, go for a jog, or, you know, and it's all very cliche, but if it works for you, you do. And so, I have thrown myself more in my work. And
so not necessarily thematically, but yes, just the volume and the fact that you're there every day.
Yeah.
5 days a week?
Yeah.
Is your art space similar to your home space?
It's starting to get, because I've had to move a few things out of Peter's house, so I've got some nice things in there which I'm trying not to get paint on. So it's certainly warm. No, it is a work environment, and there's paint racks and there's easels and, you know, there's paint everywhere. So it's not like, no, I don't fuss around there. In fact, it's quite, you know, every now and then I seem like I block myself in, so I can't even have room to. Have you ever seen Francis Bacon's studio?
No.
It's in a museum in the island now, and they took the whole thing, and there's stuff everywhere. And when you're working, I haven't got time to put that in the bin. That goes there, and then like every 12 months, you go, right, I need to take everything out and start again. So I do that, and then sort of fills up again. So yeah, it gets frantic where I haven't got time. I'm focused on this work. So.
Now, you've lived and worked in St Kilda, in and around St Kilda, for most of your adult life.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of changes have you seen around there?
Good and bad, like anything. I mean, I'd always been going to St Kilda and the Ballroom and the SB from very early days, and the Prince of Wales.
Was that an eye-opener for a youngster from the Mornington Peninsula?
Well, no, I got what I wanted, and that's what I wanted to see, and that's and I knew it was going to be there. Growing up, I go, well, where are my people? Where are my people? Oh, I found my people.
Well, let's take you back to that. You're a gay man. That's why you're here. When did you come to terms with your sexuality?
I've always just been Gavin. You know the thing, and I don't take this the wrong way, but people never say that to straight people, do they?
No.
And I know I grew up in the 70s, so it was hard, and it was a different time, and I was very flamboyant, and I stood out like a sore thumb. And I probably didn't make it easy for myself. So even my parents knew I had to get to the city. You know, it was just like Frankston in the 70s is not a fun place to be a gay man. I went to
Possibly
Frankston.
Possibly not even now.
Yeah, well, I went to Frankston Tech too. So that was fun.
What age did you start coming up to the city?
Always. I started going to the city. You just gravitate.
Do you remember the moment that you found your people?
Because
I do.
Do you?
Yeah. I remember being taken into Pokies.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Which is not really a lesbian place.
No.
It was like me and six other women in there. But it was back in the glory days of Pokies. And I was a suburban girl and I rocked up to Pokies on a Sunday night with your $8 entry fee, which gave you a free Palmer and the show. And I just could not believe my head was blown off. And that I distinctly remember that.
Yeah, well, I got taken to Pokies by the straight art student. So there you go. And I was like, oh, yeah, how long has this been going on for? I think it's just gradually, you know. I was interested in fashion. I used to listen to a radio station called Free Triple R, and Gabrielle Tolovich, who was the presenter on Saturday night, we used to write letters in and speak to people, and we'd have picnics and we'd meet all these people from the city, and sort of I still have friends from I met Paul Clifton, 15-year-old boys, and you know, that was sort of the, oh, okay, so you meet people and yeah and then you start going out and yeah
I'm always amazed by those pivotal moments in someone's life when, you know, they either end up at Pokies or another one for me was when I went to uni and I'd been listening to pop music just on Countdown and that sort of thing, and the Smiths came on the student radio and again I was like, oh, there's other music other than, you know, top 40 stuff.
Yeah.
So I sort of remember those times. You've done a bit of drag.
I have, yeah. I ran a club. I didn't start it, but it was called Seventh Heaven in...
the glory days of Seventh Heaven. I have fond memories of Seventh Heaven.
Yeah, and in Exhibition Street, I was there. And
it's a Sunday night?
Night, yep. And we had queues around to the Metro one night when I was running it. Very, you know, there wasn't much choice in those days, and it was big. And when I took it over, I just wanted, like, why can't we have, like, the best? Why can't it look international? Why can't it be, you know, fabulous? And I wanted to get performers. I had this idea, more of the London set, and, you know, I knew Lee Bowie, all that crew, and, you know, I wanted that sort of more style of performing.
Because what else was around then? So what year are we talking?
I think I had 88, 89, and then from then onwards to about 91.
Yeah, so there was Seventh Heaven. What else was going on in Melbourne?
Exactly. It's hard to remember. I mean, things opened up while I had it, like the Peel... There was the market.
The market.
No, that was closed, and then that opened. Mm. So there were things starting to happen. 397.
Riders.
That was probably my first club I went to, and Molly Meldrum was the DJ there. So that was like, I lived in Smith Street back in the day. So that was fun, and I still go out. I love going to 86, and I go to a lot of bars and Molly's. And that on Smith Street is the full turnaround. And I did say to some kids the other day while I was dancing, gee, in 2 years' time, I've been dancing on Smith Street for 40 years and no one was impressed. In fact, they were like, oh, really? Like, they didn't even comprehend. I think they looked up from their phones for 5 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Mm-hmm. How long did Seventh Heaven go for?
Four years.
I seem to remember there was a hairdresser there. Like, there was, you could go and get your hair cut.
That was mad. It was mad.
I just thought that was the best thing ever.
It was mad. And we had Candy's Bar. And anyway, so going back to that, I wanted this sort of act. And then my partner at the time would say, well, you do it. And I said, I'm not doing that. No. But then I thought if I took it more like a club kid or something and went more wild, did it my way, that it would. Resonate, and it had its time and it had its moment, and it was lots of fun, and I loved doing it, and it was more developed into more of a performance piece, because I had that art edge and I wanted it distinctive, and I wanted it each week to be something. It didn't have to be the best show, but it had to be the best idea and something new all the time. It wasn't the same, because we did have Pokies, and Pokies was an institution, but it was a different style of performing, and it was, you know, brilliant, and, you know, we miss it dearly, but that was a time in the day, like Seventh Heaven had its time. But I really loved doing that for the time. And, you know, I was like only 25 or something when I was doing all that, and I was like, I'd already had another career before then.
Maybe the naivety was a good thing.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
What brought him into it?
Oh, a friend was going overseas, and he said, oh, do you want to take this over? I think it's closing in a week, you know, and I took it over and we kept it going. You know, ours was more dress up and more fantasy, and then all of a sudden the music changed and shirts off, and, you know, and that was right for its time. And so then we looked old-fashioned, you know, like we didn't, you got to keep moving and keep going with it, or you get left behind. And, you know, things overnight just, you know, have it their day.
It had a fair amount of longevity.
Yeah, it did.
Considering how short attention span we are, you know, back then.
Yeah.
You know, something was really cool for 6 months and then,
I suppose because of the unpredictability of it all, and the, you know, the energy, and we, you know, there were people coming through, and we'd always have, like, you know, back in the day we'd have Bob Down performing, or we had someone else singing, and, you know, we just sort of kept to, yeah, it was meant to be unpredictable. And then of course we created at Cadillac Bar, Miss Candy performing, we had Candy's Bar, it was all meant to be just fun, you know, it's like, just a big party. That's what I wanted. And just bring out the kooks.
What's happening in the current queer scene, given that you're still going out dancing?
Oh, I still go out.
Very
impressed. Yeah. Hunk Show Disco I go to is probably my favourite on Smith Street. It's a lot of, it's queer, very queer. Male and female performers. I feel at home. I probably wouldn't go out if I didn't know of that place. There's things. I mean, you know, I'm not out every week. It takes a long time to recover nowadays. It doesn't, you know, I have to schedule in. Maybe I won't be working on the Friday. You know, that's all doing, you know, maybe I'll just do backgrounds.
A bit of a lie down to knock out a couple of backgrounds.
Now,
Dogs in Space. Were you in that?
No, I wasn't, because I had long red hair and I refused to cut it off. But
you did have some kind of role in a film.
Yeah, no, I did. I was friends with Michael Hutchins and all that, and I did a video for him called Viking Juice, where I come from, and that was 1993, and I basically did the whole video. It was Brenton, Stella's in it, and the glorious Vivian St. James, who's no longer with us, but she's in the video with me, and you can find it on YouTube called Viking Juice, and it's all St Kilda, me getting ready in my apartment years ago, and it was lots of fun. I knew people, we were sort of knew each other in the scene and all that. I thought, this will be it, this is when I'm going to be the big star. But you know you have a lot of those, not to be.
Can I take you back to St Kilda?
Yes.
So you've seen a lot of changes through the area. Mm-hmm. Has there been gentrification?
Well, that comes with anything. I mean, the whole world is becoming gentrified. I mean, as I always say, rich people are boring. You know, they've ruined New York, they ruined London, they ruined Paris. Oh, yes, we've got the best apartments, and, you know, and then everyone's off in Brooklyn, or, you know, like, you know, and St Kilda's like, you know, I mean, it is sort of a lot of backpackers and, you know, transient. And I suppose we do go to other places because we enjoy that. St Kilda has always been the playground of Melbourne. We don't own it. And I sort of get a bit annoyed when people go, oh, I don't want that, or I don't, you know, it's got to say, well, actually, it's always changed. And things do have to change. And if we keep trying to hold it back, we're going to get stuck. So I'm one for change, and, you know, even though we've got the Pride Centre, you know, we go, great, you know, Fitzroy Street is dead. It needs a kick in the ass to get it going again. And, you know, I'm not scared of development. I'm scared of people being pushed out. I mean, it's all very well. Buildings don't make a place. People make a place. And as you were saying before, there's been some wonderful characters in St Kilda. Most of them are are not with us anymore. But, you know, I mean, I can, you know, Renee and Neville and Pussy, all these wonderful people I've got. I was walking down the street one day with Brenton up Ackland Street, and we were all tarted up, looking like two funny old dandies. And I looked at it and I said to Brenton, oh, we're those funny old people now that people come to St Kilda have a look at. I was like, oh. Which is, I don't mind, whatever. What if the hat fits?
Do you think things like, you know, having the block shoot there and those sorts of buildings go up, you know, again, you're saying you're not opposed to change.
Well, I just laugh at the one in Grey Street now because there's so many centres for, like, the Sacred Hearts and, you know, there's crisis centres all around. No, they're not going anywhere. So these people who are moving and buying a $4 million apartment or something, are they going to be, like, going to adjust? Because they need to adjust to St Kilda. There has to be, you know, so I don't know how that's going to work because Grey Street is Grey Street and there are so many centres there that aren't going anywhere I just think, oh, well.
Because I guess you get that in sort of inner cities in any country.
Yes.
So they get gentrified, people move in,
yeah.
They don't know what it's like to live there.
Yeah.
They realise there's homeless people here, there's drugs on the streets, there's working girls, and then they want to change it.
Well, the problem with St Kilda is that there was always working girls, there's always drugs on the street, there's always alternative people, blah, blah. But what's happened is that the other people have got scared off. So all the other elements are coming to look stronger than they always, you know, because there's no other people there. So you walk down the street and you see a whole lot of homeless people. Oh, I don't want to. But they've always been there. But now because there's not they all were integrated to, there's always been junkies in St Kilda, you know. It's that's the place. But now if there's not other people, it just comes to the forefront. And I'm not moving, well, I probably will move now, I said that, until I get a little oval plaque. National treasure plaque.
National trash.
Yeah, national trash.
Do you own your flat?
I did, yes.
So you're not going to get...
But you know what, I did buy it a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did run a nightclub.
What are you saying?
You know, I made some money once.
Are you still living as an artist?
I am, yes.
Equal marriage. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I was going through a breakup while it was all happening. Mm. So, you know, did I fight for this? I don't know.
Would you have gotten married?
No. I don't think. Look, it's stupid that it wasn't, like, that we didn't have it. And it was this ugly carry-on about people, you know, I want to say, mind your own effing business. What's this worry you? Why are you so concerned? How does this affect you? It's only going to make people happy. It's only going to, like, you know, I pay taxes too, you know. Well, it seems to be my money's all right, you know, and then it's, oh, so everyone should be equal and just mind your own business. How does this affect you?
Do you think it's fear?
I just think people just want to have a, you know, someone to, you know, the other. Mm. Fear the other.
Yeah, I tend to think it's fear. It's something they don't understand and so they just naturally fear it.
Focus on it. Stop focusing. I don't worry about what you're up to.
So you dress pretty flamboyantly most of the time.
Yep.
Do you ever cop any?
Look, once a year I walk down the street and someone will go, hi, faggot. And I go, oh, still got it. But not from the world that I lived in where I'd get tacked on the street or bashed or spat on was pretty a weekly occurrence. I'm not a victim. But
back in the 70s, 80s?
In the 80s was pretty, you know, whatever. I was having fun. You know, that comes with the territory and you can walk down the wrong lane anywhere.
Were you tempted to change your style at any stage?
I'm always changing my style. Yeah, yeah.
Always been flamboyant, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So you weren't tempted to start wearing...
No, it made me want to...
Yeah, some wash jeans.
No, it's opened more doors than closed.
And is it? In what way?
And now I'm an older guy. I refuse to be invisible. And I look at people go, oh, you've given up, have you? You've just given up now, have you? And I'm like, no, I'm not giving up. I'm like, I'm here. And I was like, whatever, you can laugh all you like. I don't care. dress for you. I put this on for me today. And style is inherent, and I might be blowing my own trumpet, but I've got style, and it, you know, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, or it can. And you just that's why you know how to put things together. Well, you know, like in your house, and that's not for everyone, it's for me. And so, like, how I live my life, or how I keep my interiors, or how I do it, it's an extension of me. And I was pretty wild in the 80s, like what I look like. I mean, there wasn't people around, and there wasn't, the flaming red hair down my shoulders, and it was virtually, very androgynous.
Mm. So you were subject to violence over the years?
Yeah, I have been, yes. Hmm. Yeah. There's been scary things, and, when the AIDS epidemic come out, people spit on your AIDS in Queens, just like, what? Oh, God, just naive. And, I don't want to sound like a victim, but, everyone's journeys, But, something probably I don't dwell on. I'm pretty streetwise, pretty savvy. I always say get to A to B. If you're going from one place, get to the other. My friend, dear friend, Paul.
As long as it's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Well, sometimes you just got to. And my old friend, Paul Quick, who is not with us anymore, he'd always say, always look like you know where you're going. So, and if you always look like you know where you're going, you're halfway there.
Have you lost over the years many to HIV?
Yes, I have. Yes, like everyone of my era. And I was hearing something. I've always felt like that we were in a war, and it was like, we were in a war, and it probably curtailed sexual practice and made us, some people, more conservative or, more cautious. And
so changed sexuality?
Yeah. And maybe also we partied harder. And I remember in the 90s, we had a pretty good time, even though we had a bad time. We had a lot of great warehouse parties, a great community, very strong community that maybe I don't see that now as I did, but that might be just me. Yeah, and, it's like The Last Dance sometimes. Oh, okay, someone else has gone, or, it was devastating, and it does affect you.
When I say the word queer community, what do you think of?
I think of the past. I think of what I thought we were going to, what we were aiming for, and I had a lot of female friends. I felt it was stronger. I just felt...
So even though you were going through, you had some violence on the street, you were losing friends, you felt that there was this stronger community.
Yeah. I think we all had the same, cause or battle, and solidarity of we're pulled together.
Do you think we've lost that a bit?
I don't know if it's just my age. So I can't speak for a younger person, but I think that loneliness in our society is a big thing. I didn't feel lonely years ago, and I just feel, there was more of a sense of community.
Do you feel lonely now?
Yeah. Where do you go?
Do you think that comes with ending a very long relationship?
Maybe, because I'm used to having, someone around, and then you have to be more independent again and sort of be more proactive. But, there's less places, to sort of meet and engage. I mean, I don't need to be on the phone. I've got my, Instagram account, but I'm talking to people overseas.
So maybe in some ways, social media has kind of filled that gap a little bit. We're sort of transitioning from face-to-face to, more sort of online stuff.
And
that's not a bad thing.
No.
But it has its bad aspects.
Yeah. Yeah. There's good and bad things of everything. And, what it's had is probably better than what we had. And we've got to keep moving forward. We have to keep moving forward. And maybe it'll find a different place. But, yeah, I did feel like the sense of community in the 90s was stronger, and I maybe I was deluded. I don't know. I just there was, yeah.
I think that too, though, but we're similar age.
So yeah.
I think you're right. I think it might be age-based.
Yeah.
What's the future hold for you? I'm going to talk about your exhibition in a minute, but long-term? Any plans?
Long-term? Oh, God, I'm going to – I don't know. You keep going, oh, have I made it? I don't know. You know, you're like, oh.
What does made it mean, though?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not for you to say, is it?
Well, I guess some people measure it by money.
And
material possessions, or
yeah,
I don't know, if you're an artist, maybe column inches in a newspaper. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. I think you just survived. We survived, and you know, there was a time there was, you know, I mean, it certainly hasn't been boring, and I hope it's not going to be boring in the future. That's probably what I'm, you know.
I think I read somewhere that you hope that you die with a paintbrush or an art implement in your hand.
How romantic.
It is, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I suppose an actor wants to drop dead on stage, so the appropriate thing for a painter is to drop dead with that last stroke, just to hope it's that, you know, the last initials on my name. Well, otherwise someone's going to have to forge it and pretend they finished that painting. Hopefully it'll, yeah.
So in a few weeks you've got an exhibition coming up called The Power of the Passion.
Yeah.
Chris Orr is actually also exhibiting as well.
Yep.
So that is at 45 Downstairs, Tuesday 21st of May to Saturday, June 1. At what stage of the game are you finished that now? You're ready to present, or are you still madly finishing?
Oh, you're going to hate what I'm about to say. Chris is like going, oh, I just, you know, I finished the show over 6 months ago.
Wow.
Well, that's what I was talking about, throwing myself into it. And then it's about getting time slotted in for the exhibition space. So now I've been waiting. So I haven't been sitting. I've been doing new works and doing that. But this work is, I mean, I've added and did a bit more work, and it's on a bit of travels. I went to Myanmar, Burma, and before a lot of the troubles were there, and I saw these beautiful women selling fabrics and that we love in markets, and that sort of sprung a lot of it. And I then put carpets behind them instead of the fabrics, because I wanted to not make it so literal, but I wanted a pattern. So then I was like, pattern on pattern, and sort of almost like a dirty word in art, you know, like, and I went, oh, whatever, if that's taboo, I'll say, you know, like, I'll go there. And then I saw all the beautiful street dogs of Asia, and I, you know, all the, you know, the ratty ones and all that, and you know, just there. And then I putting them on Persian rugs and making them like, you know, it's like, you know, this instead of this street, and the sort of that's what I was playing with the show. Yeah, and it was very different from other work. So yeah, so
you, given you finished that and you're exhibiting you know, in May, does that mean you're working on your next?
Well, not so much working on. Sometimes I do bigger jobs for work in overseas and commissions. And at the moment, you know, as an artist, sometimes you need time to breathe. And I've been allowing myself to play and experiment in the studio and not have these deadlines. I don't like deadlines. I'm the opposite of other people. It stresses me out. I like to be like, you know, maybe at the last minute I'll just go and paint something else. I mean, I used to do shows, and like the start of the show and the end of the show were two different shows, because I would like, this idea, you know, when you're young, you've got so many ideas. Just slow down. Slow down, Dorothy. You'll get there, you know. So now I'm just like, okay, this is the show, and then I can start something else, or I can continue with this. I want to feel some feedback from how people respond to this work.
So when you open a show, do you go back? Like, that's how long's that on? That's nearly a...
Oh, it's so short.
It's a couple of weeks.
It's a couple of weeks.
It'll do you go every day and hang around?
No, and pretend I'm not the artist.
Like a mystery shopper or something?
Yeah, I have been known to. But, I'll go in. Yeah, I man it on a Saturday if anyone wants to come in. So Saturdays I'm there, and I'll come in if anyone wants to see me. I always come in and talk to them about the work. I have to do all the work, and, you know, that's just the venue. And so, I'm available. I mean, I don't man it, but I can go in there. I'll go in, you know, a couple of times a week, plus a Saturday, and I'll meet people in there and talk to them about it, yeah.
Well, good luck, Gavin.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thank you for coming in and chatting to me today. You've given me a little slice of queer history in Melbourne, 7th Heaven.
Yeah.
And you've taught me a little bit about art, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Good luck with the exhibition, which is coming up. So it's Power of the Pattern.
Yep.
And, good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production support by Chris Tate from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.